Gemma. So we enter a very interesting chapter, which is Devasuri Sampada, chapter 16 of the Gita, and chapter 17 of the part 2, book 2 of Essays on the Gita, on page 463. So the background and essence of the chapter is that we have been told that we have to rise above the three gunas. So to go beyond the gunas into the immutable Brahman is known. But the Gita also says that no, even when you are above the three gunas, you can continue to act. So here comes a little divergence, because traditionally when we are asked to go beyond the gunas, we are told that ultimately when you rise beyond the three gunas, that means beyond the circle of nature, then you are free, you don't need to act. So the need of action is only to lead us to that point and not further. So does a yogi then withdraw from the world? No, says the Gita. In fact, it says that you can continue to do even the most ghor karma in that state. So there is something which we are missing, because if one has risen above the gunas, how does one act? If one reads the Gita cursorily without the commentary of Sri Aurobindo, then the impression that comes is that, well, when you act, you will still act through the gunas, but you will be inwardly free. That is the impression that comes, and most people, commentators, will take that approach. But the question is, divine also acts in the world. After all, this world would not be without his action. So how does he act? Does he also act through the gunas? In which case, his action would also be limited, because the guna limits. Even a sattvic gun ultimately limits us, based on certain rules, regulations, principles, scriptures. But the divine doesn't seem to act in that direction, in that way. Rajogun creates repercussions of sukha and dukkha. So does the divine also undergo these things? Or is it just that inwardly he is free, but outwardly he is still within that limits? So here Sri Aurobindo brings to us this whole, actually it's not directly in the chapter 16, but when Sri Aurobindo brings out, one can see, yes, that's how it should be. So there must be some point of transition between our three gunas nature, trigunatmak prakriti, and the divine nature, which acts in freedom. It doesn't act according to any external stimulus or any outer compulsion, including any outer rule. So this secret actually we find in Savitri, where book 7, canto 4, Sri Aurobindo speaks of the triple soul forces. So there the trigunatmak prakriti, which is described as when the original impulsion operates within the limits of the ego. So we see that the human echo. So human echo is basically in the ego operating system when the same thing comes. It's like there is a divine impulsion to go and conquer, like Napoleon had. But he took it as my conquest. He took it as that it is my force. And after a while, when the purpose was over, he was cast aside. So that is the difference, that the impulsion is divine, because divine needs an instrument. It's like, if I write a very good poetry and the pen begins to believe that it's me, so then there is a problem. It's not the pen, it's not even the hand, it's not even the person, it is the inspiration that is coming. So this is the difference Sri Aurobindo brings out in, it's hinted in the Gita, but Sri Aurobindo brings it out very beautifully, that the three gunas also owe their origin to some aspect of the divine. He doesn't elaborate here. But we can understand with the background of Savitri that it's about those triple soul forces which are originally divine forces, and when they enter into the human ego, they become forces of sattva, rajas and tamas. So this is the background. So we have to now go through these towards the ultimate fullness of the divine action, because we have read about fullness of spiritual action. And as long as we are limited to the gunas, we cannot arrive at the fullness of spiritual action, because always, even at the highest of sattva, there would still be should I not. The mind will continue to raise questions and doubts. But the divine doesn't think and analyze. He acts. That's what Savitri says. I act, I will, I act, I see. So how does he act directly? It should be like that. Not based on the scripture says so and the scripture doesn't say so. So here Shobindo says, and of course this is there in the Gita, that within the three gunas there is a little weak spot. It's like you are closed inside a door. You have to find a weak spot. That weak spot is Sattva Guna, through which one can climb. So the first step should be to increase the Sattva Guna in a human being. As the Sattva Guna increases, and how to increase it, that he comes at the end of this chapter 16. So as the Sattva Guna increases, automatically the nature becomes ready and prepared to be lifted up by a hand which comes from outside. So people sometimes ask in this context that, well, in the ashram or will we see all kinds of people? Why didn't he call only Sattva Guna people, because they'll be most suited for the yoga? There Sri Aurobindo says, because the problems of the tamasic and the rajasic man have to be represented. So we must understand that it's not automatically that if somebody has taken to yoga, already he has crossed the Sattva Guna. No. But he will have to go through it at some point. It may be an accelerated phase, whatever it is, one has to go through Sattva Guna before the hand of the infinite pulls you into the higher spiritual realms, where you discover what Savitri discovers, becoming an instrument and channel first of the higher divine forces and then the divine himself. So this is the background, and then he describes that, well, how to know now, but there are three gunas. So Sattva Guna means what? Pure Sattva Guna without rajas. There will be no impulse to act. Sattva Guna naturally tends towards a kind of vairagya, a kind of, you know, philosophical attitude towards life. So Sri Krishna broadly categorizes it into rajo-sattvic and rajaso-tamasic. So one is rajoguna at the service of the Sattva Guna. Other is rajogun at the service of the tamogun. So that's how he describes the devasuri. And here again, he says very clearly that one should not start, because when you read this chapter, you start comparing, oh, this is in me, I am deva. And that fellow is asura. Always asura is the other person. He says, no, majority of people don't fall into any of these clear-cut categories. They are a mixed breed. Like tamogun people, pure tamogun. Their good is limited and their capacity to do evil is also limited. So it's only after a point of development that mankind parts ways in two directions. Not because God has condemned somebody, but it's the way the soul takes. Like we see that Ravan moves along a certain line. Classic example is Ravan, Kumkarn and Vibhishan. All of them are, I mean, they have a mixed combination. On one side, there are children of a Brahmin, basically. So they know that they have read the Vedas, they do tapasya. On the other hand, because of from maternal side, they have taken the asuric aspects in them. So it's a very interesting story. So all three are going along a certain line, but after a while they part ways. So Ravan goes towards a full-blown asuric manifestation. It takes the path of aggrandization of the ego. That's what the asura is. And Vibhishan takes the other path. He takes the path of towards Sattva Guna. Both of them, they are all strong people. It's not the way it is shown. Vibhishan also fights the war, defeats many asuras. And Kumbhakarna, it's very interesting. Kumbhakarna is in between. 6 months he's awake, 6 months he's asleep. He has got something which is a mixed state. We can use the word tamas. Tamoguni pradhan. And when he is in his senses, he talks very nice things. He tells Ravan, don't do this. Basically, bro, you are not taking a good road. But on the other hand, then he goes on to sleep. He has to be woken up by all kinds of extreme sensations. So this is what happens after a point of time. Mankind can take one of these two paths. And this is important because instruments of God especially, because they get so much imbued with the divine energies, that at any point of time they may fall, thinking this is me and this is mine. And an instrument which was being used by God, as in the case of Ravan, he was after all spreading the Vedas, suddenly becomes an instrument of the Asuric forces. So this is the caution. So average human beings will be a mixed lot. Third thing is that even if the worst of Asuras still has hope, so nobody is condemned eternally. If he takes the name of divine, if he chooses, he will come up. He will have to make a choice. Nature will, divine will compel him. But before that, the divine casts him down into darker and darker states. This is also there. If we want to use the word that punishment, this is the punishment. Because the more you go in towards tamas, the less natural joy you feel. And the less natural joy you feel, the more you go towards extreme stimulating activities, which include drugs and alcohol and all that. The more you go toward that, the more you fall. Till you touch rock bottom. Now, Gita doesn't talk about this, what happens after rock bottom, in this chapter. It talks in another chapter. But basically, it's a small percentage. So there is the idea of retrogression, that there is something called as adhama gati, where you actually fall down and you fall, in fact, till you touch rock bottom, because then you spring up and come back. So it's taking a long path, which is again the story of all the Jai Vijay brothers who took three lives as asuras and came back. And finally, the Gita tells us that, okay, you have to cultivate Satyagun. What is the way? So we just read a few passages. Page 463. The practical difficulty of the change from the ignorant and shackled normal nature of man to the dynamic freedom of a divine and spiritual being will be apparent if we ask ourselves more narrowly how the transition can be effected from the fettered, embarrassed functioning of the three qualities to the infinite action of the liberated man who is no longer subject to the gunas. This is the basic problem which he had ended up with, that fullness of spiritual action requires you are free from the gunas. But if still you are acting under the compulsion of the gunas, then where is the real freedom? You are freed inside, but action is still bound. That's the whole problem. And then he gives us an example down below, last 8-9 lines from below. The Ishwara, the Supreme, who is master of all her works and functions and guides and determines by them by his divine will, is indeed above this mechanism of quality, not touched or limited by her modes. But still, it would seem that he acts always through them, always shapes by the power of the Swabhav and through the psychological machinery of the gunas. So this is what he says, that it seems like that. So this would be a contradiction. And then on page 464, he comes up with that master line somewhere in the middle. What moves the world is not really the modes of Prakriti. Because if this is so, that well, all movement ultimately is subject to the to Prakriti, including Ishwara's action. Then Ishwara is also not free. Then Prakriti is the Lord, and the Lord is actually not Lord. He's just bound. So it creates a paradox. Ki Bhagwan is free or he is not free. Whether he is subject to, and then Prakriti becomes the Lord, because it can even bind the divine. So Sri Aurobindo says, what moves the world is not really the modes of Prakriti. These are only the lower aspect, the mechanism of our normal nature. The real motive power is a divine spiritual will which uses at present these inferior conditions. Now these little phrases are what Sri Aurobindo opens the door towards the supramental yoga. They are not in the Gita itself, that you know at present we are under, because the idea of transformation is not there. They must proceed from something inherent in the power of the spirit. Now, in the next half a phrase, we will see that triple soul forces is just hinted and Sri Aurobindo holds back. There must be powers in the divine will force from which these aspects of Prakriti have their origin. So we will see in the triple soul forces the three gunas as they operate in human consciousness and the goddesses which are aspects of the divine from where they emerge. So there he gives the whole picture. That's why I say that, you know, Sri Aurobindo is Sri Krishna coming again, because he had promised and it was too hurried. So he comes back, completes the missing picture. For everything in the lower normal nature is derived from the higher spiritual power of being of the Purushottama. Mattaha pravartate. It does not come into being de novo and without a spiritual cause. So this is the logic behind through which we have to, the door through which we have to pass. Few lines below. But once we get back to these sources in their purity, above this imperfection and degradation of them in which we live, we shall find that these motions put on a quite different aspect as soon as we begin to live in the spirit. Then he gives certain examples. Like Shivaji is a vibhuti of Bhavani. Now Shivaji uses everything. He uses deception, guerrilla warfare. He's an expert. He creates the illusion before the enemy that there is a very big army with handful of men. And they are duped. They don't understand. So he does all that and masterfully he breaks the spine of the Mughal Empire. So that's given to him. So is he acting according to Sattva? No. Is he acting according to pure Rajas? No. He is not acting because he wants to become ambitious man who wants to become an emperor. No. He is just an instrument and channel which the Divine Mother uses for the work. So then he says that what is behind all this that touches us in Rajas is actually there is a divine power which comes, but Rajas mistranslates. It is somebody gives me, basically we have to remember, all power belongs to one power. Everything belongs to the one divine. It may be money, it may be so-called joys of life, it may be house, wife, husband, everything. The moment we think this is mine, that's where the ego brings the distortion. So wealth is there, but one is using the wealth only for one's own kith and kin, not for the higher purposes. Wealth has been given. It comes from the divine. But instead of using it for the divine, similarly all energies, there are people who are very brilliant minds. So they've been given that intellectual brilliance, but they are using it to justify all kinds of evil in the world. So every energy owes its origin to the divine. So he says on page 465, somewhere in the middle of the first passage, the soul that lives in God acts by this spiritual will and not by the normal will of the unliberated mind. Its kinesis takes place by the spiritual force and not by the rajasic mode of nature. Precisely because it no longer lives in the lower movement to which that deformation belongs, but has got back in the divine nature to the pure and perfect sense of the kinesis. What will be the sign of such a person? Not only outwardly, but inwardly he cannot claim anything because he knows that he has just been used as an instrument or a channel. It is like that. He cannot claim. I mean, all great men who have become instruments of this kind, invariably they find it very difficult because they themselves know it. That we don't know how it was done, how it happened. Whereas when the ego operates, it claims. Then it, because naturally it is the ego, and then the movement gets distorted. So here it's about that rajasic action owes its origin to a divine kinesis, spiritual will, which is operating behind. And if you surrender to that will, then you cannot claim that this is my action anymore. What about the tamas? And again, what is behind the inertia of nature behind this tamas? So first he describes what tamas is, we'll have occasion to read this again and again. Few lines below. This tamas is an obscurity which mistranslates, we may say, into inaction of power and inaction of knowledge, the spirit's eternal principle of calm and repose, the repose which the divine never loses even while he acts, the eternal repose which supports his integral action of knowledge. The peace of the Godhead is not a disintegration of energy or a vacant inertia. So we can turn back to Savitri. We see that the Madonna of Might, what does she say when she talks about Durga? If you, I can help. That's, she says that, yet I will continue to work, heedless of virtue or of sin. I do the deed God has put into my heart. She is not deterred by the frown of hell or of heaven. She will continue to act. So when human embodiments act in a similar way, they are not caring, they are not doing something for people's praise or for rewards, but they are doing because this is what the divine has put into their hearts. Now you see the tamas, but you know, tamas also has a spiritual counterpart. She is the Madonna of suffering. So what does she do? She says, I passed by the weeping peasant, crying in his heart. I had no strength to save. But what she provides is peace and endurance. That's given to her. So all of us, when we go through difficult times, who gives us the capacity to endure? There is a very nice Hindi word called sahana shakti. Sahana is you are basically enduring. You are doing nothing. So there is lack of kindnesses. Whatever it be, you cannot do. Either you are in a prison or a state where you can do nothing. Nor you have the knowledge that what I should do. So there is neither sattva nor rajas. You are in a state of inertia. But yet there is a power in that inertia because it helps you to endure. So it's called shakti. Sahana shakti. So we have Madonna of suffering, mother of grief divine, who helps us to endure through this passage. And if we go through this with her strength within her, or rather her calm within us, then that journey, however difficult, becomes easier. Page 466, fifth line from above. The liberated soul enters into this calm and participates in the eternal repose of the spirit. This is known to everyone who has had any taste at all of the joy of liberation, that it contains an eternal power of calm. To me, the picture that comes to my mind is Shorbindo's picture in the Surat Congress. He is surrounded by everybody. Tilak is standing and pointing a finger, you know, at something. And Shorbindo is sitting. If you look at Shorbindo, amidst all the noise and ruckus that is going on, he's just sitting untouched. But he says that very few people know, it was at my behest that Tilak split the Congress. There is tremendous power in it. It's not that you are sitting helplessly. So there is a calm repose which is holds, it's a holding back of power of action. As they use an English phrase, hold the horse. So it's a power that holds the horse and does not rush prematurely into action. That is the power of eternal calm. It's not void of energy, but it's a holding back of energy. And then, page 466, same, the paragraph starts, and so too, beyond the inferior light and happiness of that purest quality of nature, sattva, the power that makes for assimilation and equivalence, right knowledge and right dealing, fine harmony, firm balance, right law of action, right position, and brings so full a satisfaction of the mind. So this looks like this is perfect, but this is limited. That's what Sri Krishna explains. So he says that it is very good, but precarious, secured by limitation, dependent on rule and condition, there is at its high and distant source a greater light and bliss, free in the free spirit. So the divine doesn't act according to fixed rules of society. Even his own rules he transcends. And that we keep seeing in both the life of Rama and Krishna. Because he sees it in a higher light, which is Jyotihi, not Prakash. Shubhendu explains that. It shows the truth and the thing to be done, and the divine goes ahead and does it. Human beings may say, oh, this is out of format. He'll say, yes, that's okay. It's out of format. But I have no format. See, that's the beauty. And everybody who rises to that point experiences it. He doesn't act according to format, the spiritual man. And he also experienced, like in Sattva, there is a limited Sukham and Prakasham. Here it is Jyotihi and Ananda. When this rises to its highest point, so this is what, now this is not there in the Gita directly. And Sri Aurobindo in a footnote says that the Gita doesn't explicitly state all this. It simply says Rahasyam Uttabam. It leaves that for the seeker to discover by his own spiritual experience. He doesn't, but Sri Aurobindo is describing it for us. And that's why he keeps saying essays on the Gita is Sri Krishna returning back, because it was too much of a rush. He had it in mind. There are many questions. So when he comes back as Sri Aurobindo, he reveals, because modern mind will raise these questions. So we see then that action is possible without the subjection of the soul to the normal degraded functioning of the modes of nature. Last line on page 467. When we grow into the spirit, this dharma or inferior law of nature is replaced by the immortal dharma of the spirit. There is the experience of a free immortal action in place of rajas, a divine illimitable knowledge in place of sattva, a transcendent power and unfathomable repose. And that's why we find that Sri Aurobindo, in his notes, there is a small line, very cryptic. A rule book for life. Like a handbook you carry. Oh, I have to do this, I have to do that. Because divine doesn't act according to that. But then how to reach there, he will describe to us. So now he comes to what the Gita. So this is like a preface, and then he says that page 469. That we shall find is the whole intention of the remaining chapters of the Gita about sattva, rajas, tamas and how they can be, you know, used. All that will come. That's why we are not going into the details. But first it prefaces the consideration of this enlightening movement by a distinction between two kinds of being, the deva and the asura. For the deva is capable of a high self-transforming sattvic action, the asura incapable. So somebody wrote some letter to Sri Aurobindo. He says, if I go by your letter and your theory, it would mean that Hiranyakashyapu was the greatest devotee of... At one place he says, very interestingly, someone writes to Sri Aurobindo, he's a great devotee, but he does not believe in the mother. Sri Aurobindo writes, then what kind of a devotee is he? You can't just play with terms. Great devotee means he sits for probably hours for meditation. Great devotee means doing all kinds of work. Sri Aurobindo says, no, that's not a devotee at all. That's not like, it's still the ego which is operating. There's still not the surrender, which is the crucial movement of the yoga. And he says the general nature of all human beings is by and large same. And ordinary turn is that our reason and will, most human beings will come under rajas at the service of tamas. So if we have to not do something, we will keep on justifying the rajasic will. It will keep on justifying, I cannot read because I don't get time. So rajas is acting in doing 100 things except reading the scriptures. So it will keep justifying that I have to gather a lot of money because after all I have to look after my children. How much they will leave them, let them also do their bit in the arena of life. Why do you want to store and stock? But the rajasic will is at the, it keeps on justifying, and it is at the service of tamas. So that's what is happens ordinarily. Last six lines on this page from below. But we actually see that men, at least men above a certain level, fall very largely into two classes. Those who have a dominant force of sattvic nature turn towards knowledge. So now he is giving first the essence. How to distinguish the sattvic nature? It is turned towards knowledge, self-control, beneficence. That means goodness. Beneficence is like kind nature, good nature, helpful nature. Beneficence, perfection. They, whatever they are doing, they want to do well. And those who have a dominant force of rajasic nature turn towards egoistic greatness. So they may do very nice things, even service of God, but they want recognition, not from God, but from people. Satisfaction of desire, the indulgence of their own strong will and personality, which they seek to impose on the world. Not for the service of man or God, but for their own pride, glory and pleasure. These are the human representatives of the devas and danavas or asuras, the gods and the titans. So, typical example is, we will see that there are temples made in India. Many names are coming to my mind. First of all, they want a slab of stone. They will give money, but they want their name. When somebody offered money to mother for Golkund, wanted their name on the slab of stone. She said, okay, we can put it on the floor. There is a temple in Varanasi which is known not because of its, it's very beautifully made. It's dedicated to Lord Rama. But the name of the temple is Birla Mandir. He never gave any money for, you know, the ashram, because they want that name. So this is how they operate. There are temples dedicated to Lord Shiva, but it's not known as Shiva's temple. It's known by the name of somebody who has built it. I'm not going to elaborate this. This is so strange. I mean, you can't forget yourself even when you are dedicating something to the divine. I went to a Sri Aurobindo center. There it was written that Sri Aurobindo's relics were established through the lotus hands of so-and-so minister. Now, this is so ridiculous, so absurd. But there are people, even there, they want their own name. So that is, we must know, he is doing apparently work of God, but he is doing his own seva of his ego, and this is an asuric nature. So we should not go just by the external action. We have to go by what is that inner state, which we may not know, but within us we have to correct it. And then the teacher has already, divine teacher has already said, Arjun, you don't worry, you are a deva nature. Because this fellow, even after so much and being so strong, he says, let my brothers take it, it's okay, I'll step back. He says, you are a deva nature, you don't worry. Who will do this? He's not, that's the big difference between Arjun and Karna. There are foolish people who compare the two. In my view, they are not comparable at all. Here is a man extremely ambitious. Here is a man completely giving himself. There is one man who for his kingdom has sold his soul because Duryodhan gave him the kingdom. Here is another man who is giving up his kingdom for the sake of his soul. So people who compare the two, I say, my God, they are not comparable. Archery is a different thing. Even there, Arjun would be superior. But that apart. So we have to understand, now all this is brought out in the Mahabharata and the Ramayana very beautifully. So that's where we see Bali and Sugriv. Why Sugriv is favored by Rama and not Bali? So Bali is very strong. He also has his own principle. But in all his things, he wants himself. Therefore, he wanted to make friends with the pact with the Asuras. So that the Vanaras can be friendly with the Asuras and, you know, they can become stronger. And Sugriv wanted to become friendly with the humans. Because he said, no, they have nice ideals and we also have some ideals. We will gain and grow in consciousness. So Ramayana and Mahabharata, you see this Deva and Asura nature very, very like a parable and two lines of evolution mankind can take. Now he is on page 471. Some of these qualities, for some time I used to, like I had noted these qualities, about 18 of them, and put in my room that this is what has to be inculcated. But then with mother's symbol, it's very interesting. Now you see, it is mother's 12 powers, 12 qualities. Now for us, that is the take home point. Why? Because they are needed for the new creation. And she has made it even better. Out of these, 8 are towards the divine, 4 are towards human beings. So if we have that, it will serve for us a much better guide, because she has put it in the context of the new creation. And she has said very clearly, center should be mother, not ego. Otherwise, all these qualities have no meaning. You are throning yourself within, see, I have such good qualities. So the same Devasuri Sampada has been brought out beautifully by the mother in a different way, in a symbol, where outer 12 qualities, they are basically the Deva nature, but in according to this yoga. The Deva nature is distinguished by an acme of the sattvic habits and qualities. So what are these? Self-control, sacrifice, the religious habit, cleanness and purity, candor and straightforwardness, not deception and trying to, you know, say something, do something else, conceal things, truth, calm and self-denial, compassion to all beings, modesty, gentleness, forgivingness, patience, steadfastness, a deep, sweet and serious freedom from all restlessness, levity and inconstancy are its native attributes. So one can just tick them and see what are the things we have still to develop. The Asuri qualities, they are also described. They are described as wealth of the Asura and wealth of the gods. Wrath, greed, cunning, treachery, willful doing of injury to others. So human beings beyond a point are in these two categories. All are equal, all are same. This is, you know, the modern liberal thought misses this point. Willful doing of injury to others, pride and arrogance and excessive self-esteem have no place in its composition. That means in the Deva nature, these things will not be there. So the Asuric qualities will not be there. So there are set of positives and there are things which will be absent in the Deva nature. But its gentleness and self-denial and self-control are free too from all weakness. It has energy and soul force, strong resolution, the fearlessness of the soul that lives in the right and according to the truth, as well as its harmlessness. Tejah, Abhyam, Dhriti, Ahinsa, Satyam. So here Ahinsa is not the external part. A person who lives inwardly in a state of Ahinsa, he doesn't want to do any willful injury to anyone. He will never create any kind of fear in anybody, because he is like that. He is always full of that state of Ahinsa. But it should not be taken for weakness. If he raises the bow, then he is an Arjuna. So that's where one has to understand the difference. Like Rama's nature. He is so benevolent, beneficent, always good. Nobody feels any fear coming near him. But when the action starts, then the greatest Asura cannot stand. So Asura also has his wealth. So we can read it. Truth is not in them, nor clean doing, nor faithful observance. The Asura will say, yeah, sir, I'll do it. And it'll never be done. You sign a land deal with an Asura? Yes, sir. You will get it. You will wait for ages. So all of us, someday or the other, unfortunately or fortunately, go through that experience. Nor clean doing, nor faithful observance. They see naturally in the world nothing but a huge play of the satisfaction of self. Theirs is a world with desire for its cause and seed and governing force and law. So you see, that's why the Buddha spoke of the desire as the governing cause of the world. But Buddha is not an asura, he is a noble one. So how is it described in the Bhavishya Puran, Vishnu Puran? So Shurvindo casually remarks in evening talks, he is an avatar of Vishnu. His name in the Vishnu Puran is Maya Moha or something like that. And he came to take the asuras out of the creation. He brought some compassion in the heart of the asuras. Because if you say there is divine, you have to surrender. No way. But you say there is no divine. Anatma. So people come to Buddha a lot many because there is nothing like, you know, God you have to worship. Very rational, intellectual. So they are very fond. But this was Buddha's way or Vishnu's way of taking them out and bringing some. And that's why you see it could never take that kind of root in India. Because in India you have the innate sense of the divine whom we worship. So this is the... Buddha is a Deva. But he is like the Deva, like Vishwamohini, who has taken them away. So what do they say? It's a world of chance, a world devoid of just relation and linked karma, a world without God, not true, not founded in truth. Now comes the important line. Whatever better intellectual or higher religious dogma they may possess, this alone is the true creed of their mind and will in action. They follow always the cult of desire and ego. They may claim. They may go, if somebody said, oh, this man, he is so good, he goes to the temple every day, he is a very religious man. Shubhindo's one line reply, some of the asuras are very religious. You will see them every day morning doing all this, holding their ear, all their night sins they come to repair. They will give generously because they believe papa will be destroyed. And then they can make fresh pop. So it is that. So we cannot go by these external things. So this is the asura, and they become instrument of a fierce, titanic, violent action, a power of destruction in the world, a fount of injury and evil. But divine uses them also because, you know, they are needed when destruction has to take place. They are used. Arrogant, full of self-esteem and drunkenness of their pride, these misguided souls delude themselves, persist in false and obstinate aims, and pursue the fixed impure resolutions of their longings. So they will always say, last line on page 472, today I have gained this object of desire, tomorrow I shall have that other. Today I have so much wealth, more I will get tomorrow, ambition basically. I have killed this my enemy, the rest too I will kill. I am a lord and king of men. I am perfect, accomplished, strong, happy, fortunate, a privileged enjoyer of the world. I am wealthy, I am of high birth. Who is there like unto me? I will sacrifice, I will give, I will enjoy. So what does the divine do with them? Page 473, in this same passage. Few lines below. The divine casts them down continually into more and more asuric births. So we cannot cheat the divine. We should know that. We cannot deceive him. He reads our intentions. Not seeking him, they find him not. And at last, losing the way to him altogether, sink down into the lowest status of soul nature, adhamam gatim. So ambition is on one side, divine is on another side. And mother has spoken about it. It's very dangerous to harbor ambition and take to spiritual life. The three doors of hell are described. They are desire, ambition and ego. He describes them, greed, desire, ambition and greed. And then of course he says that, you know, a few lines below, this graphic description, even giving its entire value to the distinction it implies, must not be pressed to carry more in it than it means. So we should not start labeling people, oh, there is an asura, there is an asura. That's not what it's meant to. It is not meant that human souls are so created by God from the beginning, each with its own inevitable career in nature. Nor is it meant that there is a rigid spiritual predestination and those rejected from the beginning by the divine are blinded by him so that they may be thrust down to eternal perdition. So these are certain religious ideas. Without naming the religion, he is describing it. All souls are eternal portions of the divine, the asura as well as the deva. All can come to salvation. Even the greatest sinner can turn to the divine. But the evolution of the soul in nature is an adventure of which Swabhava and Karma, governed by the Swabhava, are ever the chief powers. And if an excess in the manifestation of the Swabhava, the self-becoming of the soul, basically let's say a Rajogun Kshatriya, excess, sometimes it takes the path of vice. That's how Sri Aurobindo says. He is unable to contain that energy begins to control him. A disorder in its play turns the law of being to the perverse side. So this is how a person turns towards the asura, which may be full born and lead to perdition. Page 474, a new paragraph. The asuric prakriti is the rajasic at its height. It leads to the slavery of the soul in nature, to desire, wrath and greed, the three powers of the rajasic ego. And these are the threefold doors of hell. Desire, which puts you on the trail of ambition more and more and more. Wrath, I will kill, I will conquer, I will destroy my enemy. Anger, vengeance, all that comes from it. And greed. The hell into which the natural being falls. So again, because we'll start imagining a hell somewhere and where we go after death. But it's a hell of our own living, into which the natural being falls when it indulges the impurity and evil and error of its lower or perverted instinct. So again, people say, what is God's justice? This is justice. He doesn't have to do some magic and suddenly your wealth is looted by people and then you realize I did wrong. He is looting, but the problem is he's becoming more and more alone. He's becoming more and more frightful. You know, there is a whole story about Aurangzeb's last days. If you read the Bhagavad about Kansa's last days, he is living in so much suspicion and fear, like Hitler, that even his own closest friend he couldn't trust. He removes them. He said, no, 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 you people will conspire against me. Same thing with Hitler. He died as a so-called emperor. No, he heard about defeat, that's okay. But he was still in power. But see how the divine operates. He was living in hell. So we think that where is the punishment? If you want to see, this is it. It's the inner soul goes down and the joy, love, everything is lost in life. To escape from this downfall, last five lines on this page, one must get rid of these three evil forces and turn to the light of the sattvic quality. Live by the right, in true relation, in the true relation, according to the truth and the law, then one follows one's own higher good. So, basically how to follow the law of truth. So here come. To follow, page 475, to follow the law of desire is not the true rule of our nature. So either we can live by the desires and say it's okay. That means we remain bound and probably at some point go down and down. Or the other option is, there is a higher and juster standard of our works. But where is it embodied or how is it to be found? In the first place, the human race has always been seeking for this just and high law, and whatever it has discovered is embodied in its Shastra. its rule of science and knowledge. So this chapter closes with that. It says that, oh man, you should read the Shastra and live according to Shastra. So here Shastra is what are the things you need to observe. So any Shastra, any religion you go, there is a Shastra, the inner way of life. So for us, it's like we should read Mother and Sri Aurobindo, how we should live. It's no point in doing whatever I feel like doing and say that, well, Mother has talked of freedom. That's what she says, that because there is freedom, they take it for licentiousness. She speaks of that. And because everything is provided, life becomes easy, so they fall into inertia. So when we read the Mother's writings, then we understand, okay, this is the way of life. So that's how the sattvic qualities increase. So first is about Shastra, and he says, Shastra does not mean a mass of customs, some good, some bad, unintelligibly followed by the customary routine mind of the tamasic man. Shastra is not about every day morning I'll do my dhubbati. It's not about, you know, taking a bath in whatever water and then sitting 5 minutes for some puja or half an hour for puja. That's okay, maybe a beginning for an average person. Shastra is the knowledge and teaching laid down by intuition, experience and wisdom, the science and art and ethic of life, the best standards available to the race. And that's why we see how Ramayana and the Mahabharata become Dharma Shastra. Because through real life examples, they show us what we should do in certain circumstances. That's how Indian mind was molded, through the stories of Rama. Because you understand, okay, that's what is the benchmark. And that's why the great importance of Sri Aurobindo and the Mother's life as an example, so that we can follow it. If we cannot read the scriptures, we know how Sri Aurobindo lived in Baroda. If you read it, you just say, oh my God, how far are we? He's writing to his wife that, you know, up till now I have lived like a thief. I have given only 2 annas to God and kept 14 annas with myself. So that's the Shastra, which is the intuition and experience. So this we must follow. The Shastra, the recognized right that he has set up to govern his lower members by his reason and intelligent will, must therefore first be observed and made the authority for conduct and works, and for what should or should not be done, till the instinctive desire nature is schooled and abated. So first step is schooling of the lower nature of the vital desires by the Shastra. That's where obedience comes. You know, you have to obey the divine, then you enter into the freedom of the divine. By the habit of self-control, and man is ready first for a freer, intelligent self-guidance. So Shastra is that after some time you understand the whole spirit behind it, and then you are ready for the self-guidance. And then for the highest supreme law and supreme liberty of the spiritual nature. So what is that final state? Again, it's not in this chapter, but will ultimately come. Yet all Shastra is built on a number of preparatory conditions, dharmas. It is a means, not an end. You cannot find a solution to everything in the Shastra. You have to open the inner Veda and the inner guidance. And to do that, what has to be done? The supreme end is the freedom of the spirit. When abandoning all dharmas, the soul turns to God for its sole law of action. Act straight from the divine will and lives in the freedom of the divine nature. Not in the law, but in the spirit. That's what Sri Krishna has hinted. Vedavad. And those who live in Krishna. And there is an aphorism of Sri Aurobindo also. He says, the Vedas are like the lamp to guide you through the forest of ignorance. But he who has seen Krishna. You see, you are carrying a book, rule book. And you have the divine walking with you. You have a problem. What will you do? Answer is obvious. There were people who went to Mother and said, Mother, Sri Aurobindo has written Cling to Truth. I hope you have read it and you are... I mean, they didn't use the word read it. Said, you know, this man should not be in the ashram because Sri Aurobindo has said... And Mother is laughing, says... Divine is the Shastra. So that's why having an embodied divine as your master is beyond everything. Because what he says is the Shastra. Then there is no further discussion that the Vedas says this, the Upanishad says this. No, I am a vegetarian. I cannot take non-veg. If the mother says eat non-veg, eat non-veg. Very simple. Done. If the mother says work, go outside the ashram and work, go outside the ashram and work. Don't question that mother, but only in ashram we can progress and there is yoga going on. That goes beyond the Shastra. Sarva dharman parityajya mamekam sharanam raja. Not in the law, but in the spirit. This is the development of the teaching which is prepared by the next question of Arjuna. So that completes chapter 16. And then we have these two chapters going toward the great culmination. Okay, Jai Ma.